It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer, Politics Wednesday, with Wayne Moyer joining us, Rosenfield Professor of Political Science at Grinnell College. Hi, Wayne.
Hi, Ben. How are you?
I am doing well. Jim McCormick with us as well, Professor of Political Science at Iowa State University. Hi, Jim.
Hi, Ben.
You two are our international duo, our team. And boy, we have a week to look at many implications of U.S. foreign policy. Our new president being tested in terms of his statesmanship this week like no other. We want to talk a little bit later about his visit by the president of Egypt to the White House, also the king of Jordan. As a matter of fact, that visit today, on Friday, of course, the big visit, the Chinese president to President Trump's Mar-a-Lago resort. Before that, let's talk about some other items. We just heard in breaking news, gentlemen, that Steve Bannon, in a reversal by Donald Trump, has been removed from his National Security Council role as a principal in this. Now, Steve Bannon, Donald Trump's chief strategist, a political operative there. Wayne, can you give us the significance here? It's just a few minutes old, this news.
Well, I think it's highly significant because this means that the National Security Council is being transformed back to its more traditional structure, which is essentially to try to take it out of politics and direct it more in terms of pursuing U.S. national interests, per se. What's also interesting, not only is Bannon out, but the intelligence leaders are back in the National Security Council, as well as the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff.
Mm-hmm.
So I see it as moving away from sort of a populist approach to foreign policy and much more toward a traditional security approach to foreign policy.
Jim, what are you seeing in this reorganization by the president of the National Security Council?
Well, I think it's highly, symbolically, it's highly important. And substantively, I think that will follow on. What it really shows also is that apparently McMaster, you know, when he was initially appointed, apparently he had requested, and the president at that juncture said that he could reorganize the NSC in the way that he wanted. And I think this is the major manifestation of his gaining control. You know, under the directive that the president set out for the National Security Council system, he put the National Security Advisor, who is now McMaster, really in charge of this kind of structure of the Principals Committee and the Deputies Committee and the interagency group. So this is really, the traditional foreign policy types taking over.
Mm-hmm. Just a few hours old, a horrendous attack, a chemical attack in an Assyrian town has drawn some international censure as well as we move through just the headlines in international news in the last few hours. If you've been online, images circulating, children lying limp, people foaming at the mouth. Very difficult to see these, of course. Over 100 now killed in the suspected chemical attack. That would make it the deadliest chemical assault since that one in 2013 on a Damascus suburb when the Syrian government dropped sarin, this gas, killing hundreds of people as they slept. Let's hear a couple of voices before we hear from you, Wayne and Jim. Here is on CNN yesterday, Arizona Senator John McCain spreading the blame around for the chemical attacks in Syria.
We've seen this movie before. It was when Barack Obama said that they would have a red line. They crossed it, and he did nothing. And Bashar Assad and his friends, his friends, the Russians, take note of what Americans say. I'm sure they took note of what our Secretary of State said just the other day, that the Syrian people would be determining their own future themselves. That one of the more incredible statements I've ever heard, given the involvement of Hezbollah, of the Iranians, of the Russians, and, of course, the barrel bombing and precision strikes by Russian aircraft into hospitals in Aleppo. So I'm sure they're encouraged to know that the United States is withdrawing and seeking some kind of new arrangement with the Russians, and it is another disgraceful chapter in American history, and it was predictable.
Mm-hmm. Arizona's Senator John McCain yesterday on the Syrian chemical attacks. So here's another voice, former U.S. Ambassador at Large for War Crimes, also an Iowa native, as a matter of fact, Stephen Rapp, saying on Morning Edition this morning that Syrian President al-Assad has likely been emboldened by both by past policies and recent rhetoric from the Trump administration.
Well, certainly that would have been a reason to be emboldened, and frankly, the failure to ever make him pay a price for crossing one red line after another, for, as I said, doing things that weren't even done in World War II, the use of poison gas and the direct attack on medical facilities, not to mention other atrocities that we've seen elsewhere but have been done on an industrial scale, more than 50,000 men, women, and children that have been tortured to death in his prison, something that I've been deeply involved with investigating and beginning prosecutions on. He's been able to get away with these things, and frankly, the best we've had is to build the cases and find courts to bring them to.
Mm-hmm. Stephen Rapp, as a program note, Stephen Rapp, Ambassador Rapp, will be on this program tomorrow. I'll be talking with him, but let's talk a little bit about what's happened here. From what we can tell, the investigation is still going on, and those words there, Jim McCormick. What are you seeing in terms of blame for the attack?
Well, I think it really is the Syrian government that is responsible here, and it really suggests that the Syrian government stubbed its nose at the idea of in 2013 when they were supposed to turn over all of their chemical weapons to the international community for destruction. I mean, at the time, there was, reports that they had done most of that. But this attack is just entirely unacceptable. I know that there is a UN meeting, apparently a Security Council meeting this morning, and the international community could invoke what's called the Responsibility to Protect Doctrine if they were so inclined, although given that the Russians are on the Security Council, that is unlikely to be the case here. It really is going to be up to the international community, including the Trump administration, to step up to take some action here. Now, there, as with Syria always has been the case, there are not a lot of good options that can be pursued here. And clearly, by the statements of the Trump administration, they have said that the ISIS kind of effort is the more demanding one rather than getting rid of the Syrian government. And that certainly was at the end of the Obama administration, the same kind of policy. So that really has emboldened the Russians and the Iranian allies of Syria as well in terms of taking these actions. One of the things that could be done, and of course was bantered about, was a safe zone or a no-fly zone. But that would involve American commitment. And I'm not sure that the Trump administration is ready to make that commitment.
Mm-hmm. Wayne Moyer, with our new president, what are you seeing here as a difference between Barack Obama's approach to this this confounding conflict in Syria and the way President Trump is treating it?
Well, Barack Obama was very, very hesitant to put American troops on the ground and very hesitant even to aid rebel groups because many of the rebel groups were allied with al-Qaeda. I think Trump will also be extremely reluctant to put American troops on the ground, and I think he may also feel some constraints in terms of giving aid to the rebels. One thing that is different is that Obama at least was very much opposed to the Assad regime. Trump has not shown that so far, and I suspect that there will be a change on his part to show more opposition to the Assad regime. But what that will actually mean in terms of action, I think I would agree with Jim. It's going to be very difficult.
Wayne Moyer with us of Grinnell College. Jim McCormick of Iowa State University. Join our conversation, 1-866-780-9100. We're discussing a number of facets of international politics that have been presented in the news in the last few days. Let's move from Syria to Egypt. On Monday, Donald Trump moved to reset U.S. relations with the Egyptian president, Abdel Fattah al-Sisi. On Monday, he was at the White House. Donald Trump giving him a firm backing and vowing to work together to fight Islamist militants. We have to remember this was Sisi's first official U.S. visits and being elected president in 2014. President Obama never extended an invitation. Here he is, President Trump, voicing support for the Egyptian president at the Oval Office on Monday.
We agree on so many things. I just want to let everybody know, in case there was any doubt, that we are very much behind President El-Sisi. He's done a fantastic job in a very difficult situation. We are very much behind Egypt and the people of Egypt. And the United States has, believe me, backing, and we have strong backing. We are very much, and as you and I will be soon talking, we are building up our military to a level that will be the highest, probably the highest, that we've ever had. And I just want to say to you, Mr. President, that you have a great friend and ally in the United States and in me.
Wayne Moyer, describe the type of reset you see here, shifting to Trump, U.S. foreign policy toward Egypt.
Well, one thing we've done is we've totally de-emphasized human rights in Egypt, which was a high priority in terms of the Obama administration. A second thing that I think we've done is, and what we see developing in terms of Trump policy, is building unqualified support for Sunni leaders. I think this is partly to contain the expansion of Iranian influence, but it's partly as a hope of trying to keep violence under control in the Middle East. But I think it's very, very risky because with the extent of human rights violations in Egypt and all of this, this whole situation could explode over a period of time.
Mm-hmm. Jim, do you agree? A shift from a human rights focus to a fighting terrorism.
Oh, right. This is clearly a choice of interests over values here in terms of what the Trump administration has decided to do. You know, there was this tension with the Arab Spring with the Obama administration of whether they should support interests or values. And, of course, ultimately, President Obama came down and in supporting the street, if you will, the sort of the values kind of dimension. I think there's one other dimension that I would just add, and mm-hmm. I don't know if Wayne would agree with me on this or not. But, you know, one of the things that the Trump administration wants to do is to get some sort of movement in the Middle East peace discussions between the Israelis and the Palestinians. And one of the ways to do that, it seems to me, is to make certain, you know, and this is a longstanding policy, of making certain that the Egyptians, you know, are going to be standing on the sidelines or not going to be in any way trying to interfere with that. There's a longstanding treaty between Israel and Egypt, which El-Sisi has certainly agreed to continue. But I think that might be also part of the calculation here.
Mm-hmm. I would agree with that. I think that is a good point.
Mm-hmm. In the couple minutes we have before our break, this point on the Egyptian relations with the U.S. Now, President Obama froze aid to Egypt for 2 years after Sisi when he overthrew the elected president, Mohamed Morsi, in mid-2013. Morsi, a Muslim Brotherhood member, what is the future aid, future picture of aid, financial aid to Egypt, especially in light of Trump's planned cuts to the State Department budget? He took at least in his suggested planned budget, the White House budget, the State Department is one of the big losers. Jim.
Well, I think, as I recall, that Israel gets sort of the largest share of foreign assistance, usually at the $3 billion range, and for traditionally Egypt has been right behind with about $2 billion, although both of those have come down slightly. I would expect that those would be exempted. Even at the height of the Morsi takeover and then the coup in Egypt by El-Sisi, the Obama administration was reluctant to call it a coup. They said it was a restoration of democracy, is the way Secretary of State Kerry said at the time. So there was a hesitancy about how much we wanted to really cut off our connection with the military. So I suspect that will continue.
We'll be back after a short break with Jim McCormick of Iowa State University, Wayne Moyer of Grinnell College, a look at international political developments. We do value their analysis. Wayne and Jim, stand by, and we'll talk in just a moment about President Trump's visit with the King of Jordan today. Also, the upcoming visit by the president of China. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. And it's midstream on this edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. International Politics Day with Jim McCormick, a professor of political science at Iowa State University, Wayne Moyer, Rosenfield professor of political science at Grinnell College. So glad to have their expertise, especially on a week like this when we've seen so many developments, international heads, the Egyptian president visiting the White House today, the King of Jordan visiting. We have the upcoming visit by the Chinese president on Friday. In the first half hour, we were talking about the visit by the Egyptian president, the reset that seems to be going on there, sort of a characterized, I guess, as a shift from a focus on human rights, what we would say under the Obama administration, to more on a focus on fighting on terrorism, if we can put it that simply. It's much more complicated than that. But Jim is with us in Ames. Jim is with us in Ames, of course, but Nick is calling from Ames. He's been listening to our program. Hi, Nick. You had a comment about our discussion on Egypt.
Hello, yes. Two things. Number one, thank you very much for taking my call, and I'm proud to donate just $5 a month as a recent college grad, so I'm glad to help out IPR. And
fabulous, Nick. Thank you so much.
Looking forward to the drive.
Yeah, we're all looking forward to it ending.
Absolutely as well. My question, though, is we brought up the topic of interest versus values, and I guess we kind of saw the outcome with the Obama agenda kind of focused on values. And I'm really curious about the pros and the cons whenever we look at an interest-based agenda as what Trump appears to be pursuing versus the value-based agenda that Obama moved his goals forward on. And if you guys kind of take it away on that, I'd be curious about that question.
Mm-hmm. Wayne, what about that?
Well, I think it's a question of balance. American foreign policy, if it just pursues interest, doesn't give us any real purpose to mobilize other countries around us and for cooperative enterprises. And that's where values comes in. And what I've seen taking place with the Trump administration is more of a move away from values toward interests. I don't think we've given values up completely, but my sense is that a successful foreign policy has to involve pursuit of both values and interests.
Nick, thanks for that call from Ames. Let's talk a little bit before we move to the Chinese visit on Friday, to the visit going on right now. Jordan's King Abdullah meeting with Donald Trump at the White House. This comes after a recent summit hosted by the monarch renewed an Arab offer of recognition of Israel in exchange for Palestinian statehood. Jim McCormick, give us some context for this meeting. What's on the table?
Well, you know, there's been since really the Camp David Accords back in the Carter administration, there's been this effort, and even before that, Resolution 242, passed by the United Nations back in 1967, in which there was, in that resolution, a kind of a proposal to exchange land for peace or for land for recognition. So the Israelis would give up some of the land that they had seized in the 1967 Six-Day War, and the other part of the bargain was that the Arab states would recognize the state of Israel. Of course, Resolution 242 has had a checkered history because immediately both Israel and the Arab states rejected that resolution back four decades ago. But what has happened is with the Camp David Accord and with the subsequent kind of changes that come about, there's been the movement towards accepting basically the premises of that resolution. And it's, of course, reflected in the Arab states now saying that with they will recognize the state of Israel for the return of these lands. The kind of difficulty here at the moment, it seems to me, as even within the last few months, Prime Minister Netanyahu has sort of moved away from the so-called two-state solution here, which would involve the creation of a state of Palestine here, a formal state of Palestine, and a recognition of Israel. But this offer is being brought back on the table. It goes back really to about, I think, 2002, when the Arab League also proposed something similar that King Abdullah is talking about here. So this would be, if this were to be the sort of the model for the final negotiations, this would be a very, very big breakthrough.
How is Trump, let me put this to you, Wayne, how is Trump engaging differently than his predecessor? I'm recalling some time ago that Donald Trump suggested there might be alternatives to this widely recognized two-state solution.
Well, I'm beginning to think that Trump is moving back in the direction that has been pursued by previous administrations. And the visit with the King of Jordan, I think, is probably a bit of evidence of that. That Trump has become more critical of Israeli settlements over time, and he has a negotiator in the Middle East right now talking to various leaders, and clearly, as Jim says, getting Jordan on board and bringing the other Arab states on board is a pretty important thing if you do want to produce some kind of Middle East settlement.
Mm-hmm. President Trump facing his most critical week of statesmanship so far, that meeting with the King of Jordan today, the Egyptian meeting on Monday, then on Friday, he has his first meeting with the Chinese president, Xi Jinping, focuses there, trade, North Korea, certainly. They piped up and made sure they would be a major focus. Also, global warming expected to be on the table there. Worries about North Korea's nuclear capabilities growing within the past few hours. North Korea firing a ballistic missile off the coast of the Korean Peninsula, a missile that fell into the Sea of Japan. This is one of several that the country has test fired in recent months. And just to throw this in here, before I get a response from you two, an interview in the Financial Times published on Sunday, Donald Trump saying he's prepared to act unilaterally should China not help out with North Korea. Jim, tell us about this meeting and what Donald Trump thinks he can get out of it, in regards to North Korea, which seems to be his one of his priorities talking with the Chinese president.
Right. I mean, the effort of the United States has been really for the longest time to get the Chinese to put more pressure on the North Koreans. I mean, they, in some cases, the Chinese hold really the critical kind of card here in terms of really putting pressure on the North Koreans. Although that's not an absolute, it seems to me, because you've got such an unpredictable leader in North Korea. But I think what President Trump is talking about, that he can somehow strike a bargain, that he would do something on trade, I'm not sure that that's really feasible, but at least that's what he's talked about, that the bargain would be that the Chinese would put more pressure on the North Koreans in terms of because of some effort that the United States would make on trade with regard to China or withhold trade.
Well, what would that be? Because China is the largest source of the U.S. trade deficit.
Yeah,
Donald Trump wants it to go the other way, right?
Yeah, that's why I'm not sure what he has in mind about how he could really think that he could bargain. I mean, there's really not much pressure except sort of diplomatic jawboning that the United States has with the North Koreans, and to make the Korean Peninsula nuclear free. I mean, I suppose one of the bargains, and I don't think the Trump administration is inclined to do this, is to give up this anti-missile system that they've been moving into South Korea. I think that would be a very difficult move given the kind of commitment that the Trump administration has made.
Wayne Moyer, what do you see the chances of getting the North Koreans to steer away from their pursuit of missiles that could deliver nuclear weapons to many parts of the world?
I think it's extraordinarily difficult. I think that what Trump is likely to do if he doesn't get a commitment from the Chinese, which I He may get some increased commitment to pressure North Korea, but China still has a stake in keeping that regime in North Korea intact, fearing the consequences if the regime falls, and then you get American troops up on the border with China. I think what Trump will do, I don't think he'll take military action, but I think he will try indirect sanctions, sanctioning Chinese firms that deal with North Korea. I don't know how successful that will be. But somehow or other, a Chinese firm that deals with North Korea that also deals with the United States may well find themselves in difficulty dealing with the United States in the days ahead.
Now, one of the things they've talked about, Wayne, just to add to that, I mean, you know, some of the financial institutions that have been sort of money laundering efforts for the North Koreans might be a tactic that the United States could use again. How successful, I don't know.
Mm-hmm. With this upcoming Chinese visit, not only North Korea, we talked a little bit about trade. That'll certainly be a focus. The U.S. wanting to, as I said, China, the largest source of the U.S. trade deficit. Not clear what Donald Trump's policies can do about that. But this other facet, global warming, we had a turnabout there with this administration. Is it the case now, Wayne, that China is more progressive in terms of tackling climate change than the U.S., at least in terms of policy?
Well, China has now become the leader, if you would, in the global movement to come to grips with climate change. The U.S. was the leader before, but the change in the Trump administration has now created a vacuum on the side of people who are governments that want to take very positive action to deal with climate change. And President Xi Jinping is doing his best to promote the fact that he is the leader in dealing with climate change. I don't think China's as progressive as the Europeans are, for instance, but in terms of political communications, the Chinese leader is clearly making the most of this.
Mm-hmm. But before we turn the last 10 minutes to domestic politics, I'd just like your observations about, we have these initial visits by nation leaders coming to the U.S. If you were an international leader coming to meet President Trump for the first time, how would you want to size things up? How would you size up a very unconventional U.S. president, Jim McCormick?
Well, that's a great question. I think the one of the things that these leaders undoubtedly do is to figure out or try to figure out who is mostly got the president's ear in terms of sort of the direction of foreign policy and international relations generally. And so you try to figure out, is it the National Security Advisor, which has traditionally been preeminent here, or Mr. McMaster or General McMaster or not? Or is it the Secretary of State, or is it Mattis at the Secretary of Defense? I think that's what you look for. And then also, you know, is it a Steve Bannon, for example, or, you know, has been brooded about? Is it the son-in-law, Kushner, and so on, that really has the president's ear on foreign policy? So that's what I think what you would try to do rather than, particularly with a non-predictable or at least a non-conventional politician here that Trump represents.
Mm-hmm. And of course, the optics, I don't know how important those are, but we remember the visit of the German Chancellor Angela Merkel in an awkward situation where it seemed that President Trump didn't open to shake hands with the German Chancellor. Wayne Moyer, quickly on this question before we move to a bit of domestic politics before we have to say goodbye.
Well, one of the things that I suspect that Xi Jinping and other leaders are trying to get a sense of is just how well informed Trump is on issues and how effectively he can discuss these issues on his own without support of those around him. And then some sense of what the president, how the president's mind really works, and perhaps getting a sense of how he might react to certain initiatives or certain things happening in the future.
Mm-hmm. Quickly, sort of semi-domestic, also international politics, the Russia investigations update. Jim, quickly, where do we stand in terms of these three investigations, the House, the Senate, the FBI, into both Russian meddling in our 2016 election campaign, also into the questions of whether any Trump campaign staff colluded with Russians at that time?
Right. I think the Senate investigation and Senate Intelligence Committee is probably going forward in the sort of the most expeditious kind of fashion here. The House Intelligence Committee is a bit stalled because of the controversy between the chair and the ranking minority member. I'm not sure what the FBI investigation, how it's proceeding. Of course, the latest thing is, as I'm sure our listeners are aware of, is that this whole issue of unmasking of I guess, intelligence reports, and what was the involvement of Susan Rice, and was there any kind of political motivation in some of this unmasking? So I think that's another part of this that will probably be folded into both intelligence committees' investigations.
Mm-hmm. Wayne, how do you see that? Fit that into the bigger picture. The latest news, ex-Obama National Security Advisor Susan Rice back in the political crosshairs here. As I understand it, there are unsubstantiated reports, primarily on Breitbart, that she disclosed the names of Trump aides swept up by some surveillance of foreign targets.
Well, I think the most significant aspect of all this, it keeps the story in the news. Another question is this just a diversion to try to divert the public attention from what was actually happening between the Trump group and the Russians? And then there's another question which is not being asked is, okay, if as National Security Advisor, you know of some contacts between leaders in this country of any sort and Russian leaders, don't you really need to know about that and who they were? Now, the sense I get is it wasn't that she was asking for new intelligence, but trying to take the intelligence that she already had and tried to find out who really was behind the contacts between the Russians and various Americans.
There might be one other element to this, Ben, if I could throw this in,
yep.
And that is, when these names were unmasked, was it also shared with other people in the National Security Council or in the intelligence community? I think that's where the investigation might go as well, in terms of looking at, you know, I mean, because Susan Rice has denied that she leaked any of these, but it obviously could be the factor that others might have leaked these things.
Okay, quickly to domestic politics, the big story, the Gorsuch confirmation. Senate Republicans preparing to abolish, I guess, the final vestige of power that the minority has in the Senate to block presidential nominations. Senate Democrats seem to have the votes to filibuster Judge Neil Gorsuch. The GOP has pledged to change Senate rules to allow confirmation with a simple majority of 51 instead of 60. On Meet the Press this week, Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell reiterating his contention that Judge Gorsuch will be confirmed to the high court, saying a rule change depends on actions by Democrats who have promised a filibuster. And let's listen to Senate Majority Leader McConnell.
Yeah, what I can tell you is that Neil Gorsuch will be confirmed this week. How that happens really depends on our Democratic friends. How many of them are willing to oppose cloture on a partisan basis to kill a Supreme Court nominee? Never happened before in history, in the whole history of the country. In fact, filibustering judges at all is a rather recent phenomenon, started by your next guest, Senator Schumer, after George Bush, 43, got elected president. We didn't used to do this. Clarence Thomas was confirmed 52-48, the most controversial Supreme Court nominee in history, and not a single senator said he has to get 60 votes.
Okay, on that same program, Senate Minority Leader, New York Democrat Chuck Schumer, says a rule change in the Senate is in the hands of the GOP.
It looks like Gorsuch will not reach the 60-vote margin. So instead of changing the rules, which is up to Mitch McConnell and the Republican majority, Why doesn't President Trump, Democrats and Republicans in the Senate sit down and try to come up with a mainstream nominee? Look, when a nominee doesn't get 60 votes, you shouldn't change the rules. You should change the nominee.
Okay, so what do you think of the case that the Democrats and the Republicans and the Senator are making here, Jim McCormick? Can they both have a good case?
Oh, I guess they can both have a good case. But after all, the president nominates and the Senate disposes and decides. I mean, that's the procedure. I think that, you know, Senator Schumer saying that in effect that, you know, that the Democrats would have a veto over the nomination is really going beyond the process. As I said before, though, I think that getting rid of the filibuster over this is just absolutely disastrous for the traditions of the Senate and for the good of the country.
Mm-hmm. How will it change the Senate from here on out? Because once you do this, there's presumably no going back? Jim?
I don't think so. I don't think there's, I mean, they could technically, but it's really unlikely that they will, you know, prize this kind of a possession that they have, you know, to get things done in a mm-hmm. much more expeditious fashion.
We have about a minute left. I want to get to Wayne here.
Wayne, sure.
with your thoughts, Wayne, on how this may change the Senate.
Well, in some ways, I think this is almost inevitable given the polarization that has taken place in the Senate. And if Hillary Clinton had been elected president, any nomination she made probably would have been filibustered by the Republicans. And so I think that it was inevitable that the filibuster would in terms of Supreme Court appointments would end now.
Reading some analysis today, wondering if this tit-for-tat ends here, the power to filibuster, perhaps major legislation might be next. Jim?
I hope not. Again, but I do think what this does is, you know, the court is already very political, but it even makes it more political, and I think that's not good for the country.
Okay, Jim McCormick, you are very good for this program with your analysis. We can be assured of that. Professor of Political Science at Iowa State University. You as well, Wayne Moyer, Rosenfield Professor of Political Science at Grinnell College. Our international team on board today. Thanks for an hour that went far too quickly. Wayne and Jim, we appreciate your expertise.
Thank you very much, Ben.